Side 13. Victor got only 2 hours sleep, but got up feeling remarkably refreshed and optimistic. It was all over. Things were going to be a whole lot better now. Ginger had been quite nice to him last night. Well, a few hours ago. And whatever it was in the hill had been well and truly buried. You got that sort of thing sometimes, he thought, as he poured some water into the cracked basin and had a quick wash. Some wicked old king or wizard gets buried and their spirit creeps about, trying to put things right or something. Well-known effect. But now there must be a million tons of rock blocking the tunnel, and I can't see anyone doing any creeping through that. The unpleasantly alive screen surfaced briefly in his memory, but even that didn't seem so bad now. It had been dark in there. There had been lots of moving shadows. He had been wound up like a spring in any case. No wonder his eyes had played tricks on him. There had been the skeletons, too, but even they now lacked the power to terrify. Victor had heard of tribal leaders up on the cold plains who'd be buried with whole armies of mounted horsemen so that their souls would live on in the next world. Maybe there was something like that here once. Yes, it all seemed much less horrifying in the cold light of day. And that's just what it was. Cold light. The room was full of the kind of light you got when you woke up on a winter's morning and knew by the light that it had snowed. It was a light without shadows. He went to the window and looked out on a pale silver glow. Holy Wood had vanished. The visions of the night fountained up in his mind again, as the darkness returns when the light goes out. Hang on, hang on, he thought, fighting the panic. It's only fog. You're bound to get fog sometimes, this close to the sea, and it's glowing like that because the sun's out. There's nothing occult about fog. It's just fine drops of water floating in the air. That's all it is. He dragged his clothes on and threw open the door to the passage and almost tripped over Gaspard, who had been lying full length in front of the door like the world's most unwashed draft excluder. The little dog raised himself unsteadily on his front paws, fixed Victor with a yellow eye, and said, I just want you to know, all right, that I ain't lying in front of your door 'cause of any of this loyal dog protecting his master nonsense, okay? It's just that when I got back here... Oh, shut up, Gaspard. Victor opened the outer door. Fog drifted in. It seemed to have an exploratory feel to it. It came in as if it had been waiting for just this opportunity. Fog's just fog, he said aloud. Come on, we're going to Ankh-Morpork today, remember? My head, said Gaspard. My head feels like the bottom of a cat's basket. You can sleep on the coach. I can sleep on the coach if it comes to that. He took a few steps into the silvery glow and was almost immediately lost. Buildings loomed vaguely at him in the thick, clammy air. Gaspard, he said hesitantly. Fog's just fog, he repeated, but it feels crowded. It feels like that if it suddenly went away, I'd see lots of people watching me from outside. And that's ridiculous, because I am outside, so there's nothing outside of outside. And it's flickering. I expect you'll be wanting me to lead the way, said a smug voice by his knee. It's very quiet, isn't it? Said Victor, trying to sound nonchalant. I expect it's the fog muffling everything. Of course, maybe ghastly creatures have come up out of the sea and murdered every mortal soul except us, said Gaspard conversationally. Shut up! Something loomed up out of the brightness. As it got closer, it got smaller, and the tentacles and antennae that Victor's imagination had been furnishing became the more or less ordinary arms and legs of Sol Dibbler. Victor? He said uncertainly. Sol? Sol's relief was visible. Can't see a thing of this stuff, he said. We thought you got lost. Come on, it's nearly noon. We're more or less ready to go. I'm ready. Good. Fog droplets had condensed on Sol's hair and clothing. He said, where are we exactly? Victor turned round. His lodgings had been behind him. The fog changes everything, doesn't it? Said Sol unhappily. Do you think your little dog can find his way to the studio? He seems quite bright. Growl, growl, said Gaspard, and sat up and begged in what Victor at least recognized as a sarcastic way. My word, said Sol. It's as if he understands, isn't it? Gaspard barked sharply. After a second or two, there was a barrage of excited answering barks.
"Of course, that'll be Laddie," said Sol. "What a clever dog!"
Gaspode looked smug.
"Mind you, that's Laddie in a nutshell," said Sol as they set off towards the barking. "I expect he could teach your dog a few tricks, eh?"
Victor didn't dare look down. After a few false turns, the archway of Century of the Fruit Bat passed overhead like a ghost. There were more people here. The site seemed to be filling up with lost wanderers who didn't know where else to go. There was a coach waiting outside Dibbler's office, and Dibbler himself stood beside it, stamping his feet.
"Come on, come on," he said. "I've sent Gaffer ahead with the film. Get in, the pair of you."
"Can we travel in this?" said Victor.
"What's to go wrong?" said Dibbler. "There's one road to Ankh-Morpork. Anyway, we'll probably be well out of this stuff when we leave the coast. I don't see why everyone's so nervy. Fog's fog."
"That's what I say," said Victor, climbing into the coach.
"It's just a mercy we finished blown away yesterday," said Dibbler. "All this is probably just something seasonal. Nothing to worry about at all."
"You said that before," said Sol. "You said it at least 5 times so far this morning."
Ginger was hunched on one seat, with Laddie lying underneath it. Victor slid along until he was next to her.
"Did you get any sleep?" he whispered.
"Just an hour or two, I think," she said. "Nothing happened. No dream or anything."
Victor relaxed.
"Then it's really over," he said. "I wasn't sure."
"And the fog?" she demanded.
"Sorry?" said Victor guiltily.
"What's causing the fog?"
"Well," said Victor, "as I understand it, when cool air passes over warm ground, water is precipitated out of..."
"You know what I mean. It's not like normal fog at all. It sort of drifts oddly."
She finished lamely.
"And you can nearly hear voices," she added.
"You can't nearly hear voices," said Victor, in the hope that his own rational mind would believe him. "You either hear them or you don't. Listen, we're both just tired, that's all it is. We've been working hard and, not getting much sleep, so it's understandable that we think we're nearly hearing and seeing things."
"Oh, so you're nearly seeing things, are you?" said Ginger triumphantly. "And don't you go around using that calm and reasonable tone of voice on me," she added. "I hate it when people go around being calm and reasonable at me."
"I hope you two lovebirds aren't having a tiff."
Victor and Ginger stiffened. Dibbler clambered up into the opposite seat and leered encouragingly at them. Sol followed. There was a slam as the driver shut the carriage door.
"We'll stop for a meal when we're halfway," said Dibbler, as they lurched forward.
He hesitated and then sniffed suspiciously.
"What's that smell?" he said.
"I'm afraid my dog is under your seat," said Victor.
"Is it ill?" said Dibbler.
"I'm afraid it always smells like that."
"Don't you think it would be a good idea to give it a bath?"
A mutter on the edge of hearing said,
"Do you think it would be a good idea to have your feet bitten right off?"
Meanwhile, over Holywood, the fog thickened. The posters for Blown Away had been circulating in Ankh-Morpork for several days, and interest was running at fever pitch. They'd even got as far as the university this time. The librarian had one pinned up in the fetid, book-lined nest he called home. Well, in fact, he called it Ook, but probably in translation it meant home. And various others were surreptitiously circulating among the wizards themselves. The artist had produced a masterpiece. Held in Victor's arms, against the background of the flaming city, Ginger was portrayed as not only showing nearly all she had, but quite a lot of what she had not, strictly speaking, got. The effect on the wizards was everything that Dibbler could possibly have hoped for. In the uncommon room, the poster was passed from hand to shaking hand, as if it might explode.
There's a girl who's got it," said the Chair of Indefinite Studies.
He was one of the fattest wizards, and so overstuffed that he seemed to be living up to his title. He looked as though horsehair should be leaking from frayed patches. People felt an overpowering urge to rummage down the side of him for loose change.
"What's it, Chair?" said another wizard.
You know, it, oomph. The old way."
They watched him politely and expectantly, like people awaiting the punchline.
"Good grief. Do I have to spell it out?" he said. "He means sexual magnetism,"
said the lecturer in recent runes happily. "The lure of wanton soft bosoms and huge pulsating thighs and the forbidden fruits of desire, which—"
A couple of wizards carefully moved their chairs away from him.
"Ah, sex," said the Dean of Pentacles, interrupting the lecturer in recent runes in mid-sigh. "Far too much of it these days, in my opinion."
"Oh, I don't know," said the lecturer in recent runes. He looked wistful.
The noise woke up Wendell Poons, who had been dozing in his wheelchair by the fire. There was always a roaring fire in the uncommon room, summer or winter.
What's that?"
he said. The Dean leaned towards an ear.
"I was saying," he said loudly, "that we didn't know the meaning of the word sex when we were young."
"Well, that's true. That's very true," said Poons.
He stared reflectively at the flames.
"Did we ever find out, do you remember?"
There was a moment's silence.
"Say what you like, she's a fine figure of a woman," said the lecturer in recent runes defiantly.
"Several young women," said the Dean.
Wendell Poons focused unsteadily on the poster.
"Who's the young fella?" he said.
"What young fellow?" said several wizards.
"He's in the middle of the picture," said Poons. "He's holding her in his arms."
They looked again.
Him," said the chair dismissively.
"Seems to me I've seen him before," said Poons.
"My dear Poons, I hope you haven't been sneaking off to the moving pictures," said the Dean, grinning at the others. "You know, it's demeaning for a wizard to patronize the common entertainments. The Arch-Chancellor would be very angry with us."
What's that?"
said Poons, cupping a hand to his ear.
"He does look a bit familiar, now that you mention it," said the Dean, peering at the poster.
The lecturer in recent runes put his head on one side.
"It's young Victor, isn't it?" he said.
"Eh?"
said Poons.
"You know, he could be right," said the Chair of Indefinite Studies. "He had the same type of weedy moustache."
"Who's this?"
said Poons.
"But he was a student."
"He could have been a wizard," said Dean.
"Why would he want to go off and fondle young women?"
"It's Victor, all right, but not our Victor. Says here he's Victor Maraschino," said the chair.
"Oh, that's just a click name," said the lecturer in recent runes, airily. "They all have funny names like that. Dolores de Sin, and Blanche Languish, and Rock Cliff, and so on."
He realized they were looking at him accusingly.
Or so I'm told," he added lamely, "by the porter. He goes to see a click nearly every night."
"What are you on about?"
said Poons, waving his walking stick in the air.
"The cook goes every night, too," said the chair. "So do most of the kitchen staff. You just try getting so much as a ham sandwich after 9 o'clock.
Just about everyone goes," said the lecturer. "Except us."
One of the other wizards peered intently at the bottom of the poster.
"It says here," he said, "a saga of passion and broad staircases in Ankh-Morpork's turbulent history."
"Ah, it's historical then, is it?" said the lecturer.
"And it says a epic love story that astounded goddesses and men."
"Oh, religious as well."
"And it says with a 1,000 elephants."
"Ah, wildlife. Always very educational, wildlife,"
said the chair, looking speculatively at the Dean. The other wizards were doing so too.
"It seems to me," said the lecturer slowly, "that no one could possibly object to senior wizards viewing a work of historical, religious, and wildiflorific interest."
"University rules are very specific,"
said the Dean, but not very enthusiastically.
"But surely only meant for the students," said the lecturer.
I can quite understand that students shouldn't be allowed to watch something like this. They'd probably whistle and throw things at the screen. But it couldn't seriously be suggested, could it, that senior wizards such as ourselves shouldn't examine this popular phenomenon?
Poons's flailing walking stick caught the dean sharply across the back of his legs.
I demand to know what everyone's talking about, he snapped.
We don't see why senior wizards shouldn't be allowed to watch the moving pictures,
bellowed the chair.
Jolly good thing, too,
snapped Poons.
Everyone likes to look at a pretty woman.
No one mentioned anything about any pretty woman. We were far more interested in examining popular phenomenons,
said the chair.
Call it what you like,
cackled Windlepoons. If people see wizards strolling out of the gate and going into a common moving picture pit, they'll lose all respect for the profession, said the dean. It's not even as if it's proper magic. It's just trickery.
You know, said one of the lesser wizards thoughtfully, I've always wondered exactly what these wretched cliques are. Some kind of puppet show, are they? Are these people acting on a stage? Or a shadow play?
See, said the chair, we're supposed to be wise, and we don't even know.
They all looked at the dean.
Yes, but who wants to see a lot of young women dancing around in tights?
He said. Hopelessly. Ponder Stibbons, luckiest postgraduate wizard in the history of the university, sauntered happily towards the secret entrance over the wall. His otherwise uncrowded mind was pleasantly awash with thoughts of beer, and maybe a visit to the cliques, and maybe a Clatchian extra-hot curry to round off the evening. And then it was the second worst moment of his life. They were all there, all the senior staff, even the dean, even old Poons in his wheelchair, all standing there in the shadows, looking at him very sternly. Paranoia exploded its dark fireworks in the dustbin of his mind. They were all waiting just for him. He froze. The dean spoke. He began, and then seemed to catch up with his tongue.
"Oh, what's this? What's this? Forward this minute, that man!"
Ponder hesitated, then he ran for it. After a while, the lecturer in recent runes said,
"That was young Stibbons, wasn't it? Has he gone?"
"I think so. He's bound to say something to someone."
"No, he won't," said the dean. "Do you think he saw where we'd taken out the bricks?"
"No, I was standing in front of the holes,"
said the chair.
Come on, then. Where were we? Look, I really think this is most unwise, said the dean. Just shut up, old chap, and hold this brick.
Very well, but tell me this. How do you propose to get the wheelchair over?
They looked at Poons's wheelchair. There are wheelchairs which are lightweight and built to let their owners function fully and independently in modern society. To the thing inhabited by Poons, they were as gazelles to a hippopotamus. Poons was well aware of his function in modern society, and as far as he was concerned, it was to be pushed everywhere and generally pandered to. It was wide and long and steered by means of a little front wheel and a long cast-iron handle. Cast-iron, in fact, featured largely in its construction. Bits of Baroque ironwork adorned its frame, which seemed to have been made of iron drain pipes welded together. The rear wheels did not, in fact, have blades affixed to them, but looked as though these were optional extras. There were various dread levers which only Poons knew the purpose of. There was a huge oilskin hood that could be erected in a matter of hours to protect its occupant from showers, storms, and probably meteor strikes and falling buildings. By way of light relief, the front handle was adorned with a selection of trumpets, hooters, and whistles, with which Poons was wont to announce his progress around the passages and quadrangles of the university. For the fact was that although the wheelchair needed all the efforts of one strong man to get it moving, it had, once actually locomotive, a sort of ponderous unstoppability. It may have had brakes, but Windlepoons had never bothered to find out. Staff and students alike knew that the only hope of survival, if they heard a honk or blast at close range, was to flatten themselves against the nearest wall, while the dreaded conveyance rattled by.
"We'll never get that over," said the Dean firmly. "It must weigh at least a ton. We ought to leave him behind anyway. He's too old for this sort of thing."
"When I was a lad, I was over this wall every night,"
said Poons resentfully. He chuckled.
"We had some scrapes in those days, I can tell you. If I had a penny for every time the watch chased me home."
His ancient lips moved in a sudden frenzy of calculation.
"I'd have 5 pence halfpenny."
"Maybe if we—"
The chair began, and then said,
"What do you mean, 5 pence halfpenny?"
"I recall once they gave up halfway," said Poons happily. "Oh, those were great times. I remember me and old Numbers Richter and Tudgis Spold climbed up on the Temple of Small Gods, you see, in the middle of a service, and Tudgy had got this piglet in a sack, and he—"
"See what you've done," complained the lecturer in recent rooms. "You've set him off now." "We could try lifting it by magic," said the chair. "Gindle's effortless elevator should do the trick."
"And then the high priest turned round, and the look on his face, and then old Numbers said, 'Let's—'"
"It's hardly a very dignified use of magic," sniffed the Dean.
"Considerably more dignified than heaving the bloody thing over the wall ourselves, wouldn't you say?"
said the lecturer in recent rooms, rolling up his sleeves. "Come on, lads."
"And next thing, Pimple was hammering on the door of the Assassin's Guild, and then old Scummidge, who was the porter there—" "He was a right terror. Anyway, he came out, and then the guards came around the corner."
"Already? Right.
Which puts me in mind of the time me and Cucumber Framer got some glue and went round to—"
"Up your end, Dean,"
the wizards grunted with effort.
"I can remember it as if it was only yesterday. The look on his face when—"
"Now lower away."
The iron-shod wheels clanged gently on the cobbles of the alley. Poons nodded amiably.
"Great times, great times," he muttered, and fell asleep.
The wizards climbed slowly and unsteadily over the wall, ample backsides gleaming in the moonlight, and stood wheezing gently on the far side.
"Tell me, Dean," said the lecturer, leaning on the wall to stop the shaking in his legs, "have we made the wall higher in the last 50 years?
"I don't think so. God, used to go up it like a gazelle. Not many years ago. Not many at all, really."
The wizards wiped their foreheads and looked sheepishly at one another.
"Used to nip over for a pint or three most nights," said the chair.
"I used to study in the evenings," said the Dean primly.
The chair narrowed his eyes.
"Yes, you always did," he said. "I recall."
It was dawning on the wizards that they were outside the university at night and without permission for the first time in decades. A certain suppressed excitement crackled from man to man. Any watcher trained in reading body language would have been prepared to bet that, after the click, someone was going to suggest that they might as well go somewhere and have a few drinks. And then someone else would fancy a meal. And then there was always room for a few more drinks. And then it would be 5 a.m, and the city guards would be respectfully knocking on the university gates and asking if the Arch-Chancellor would care to step down to the cells to identify some alleged wizards who were singing an obscene song in 6-part harmony, and perhaps he would also care to bring some money to pay for all the damage. Because inside every old person is a young person wondering what happened. The chair reached up and grasped the brim of his tall, wide and floppy wizarding hat.
"Right, boys," he said. "Hats off."
They de-hatted, but with reluctance. A wizard gets very attached to his pointy hat. It gives him a sense of identity. But as the chair had pointed out earlier, if people knew you were a wizard because you were wearing a pointy hat, then if you took the pointy hat off, they'd think you were just some kind of rich merchant or something. The Dean shuddered.
"Oh, it feels like I've taken all my clothes off," he said.
"We can tuck them in under Poons's blanket," said the chair. "No one'll know it's us."
"Yes," said the lecturer in recent runes, "but will we?"
"They'll just think we're, well, solid burgers."
"That's just what I feel like," said the Dean, "a solid burger."
"Or merchants," said the chair.
He smoothed back his white hair.
"Remember," he said, "if anyone says anything, we're not wizards, just honest merchants out for an enjoyable evening, right?"
"What does an honest merchant look like?" said a wizard.
"How should I know?" said the chair. "So no one is to do any magic," he went on. "I don't have to tell you what'll happen if the Arch-Chancellor hears that his staff has been seen at the common entertainments."
"I'm more worried about our students finding out," shouted the Dean.
"False beards," said the lecturer in recent runes triumphantly. "We should wear false beards."
The chair rolled his eyes.
"We've all got beards," he said. "What kind of disguise would false beards be?"
"Ah, that's the clever bit," said the lecturer. "No one would suspect that anyone wearing a false beard would have a real beard underneath, would they?"
The chair opened his mouth to refute this and then hesitated.
"Well," he said.
"But where'd we get false beards at this time of night?" said a wizard doubtfully.
The lecturer beamed and reached into his pocket.
"We don't have to," he said. "That's the really clever bit. I brought some wire with me, you see, and all you need to do is break two bits off, twiddle them into your sideburns, then loop them over your ears rather clumsily like this," he demonstrated. "And there you are."
The chair stared.
"Uncanny," he said at last. "It's true. You look just like someone wearing a very bad-made false beard."
"Amazing, isn't it?"
said the lecturer happily, passing out the wire.
"It's headology, you know."
There were a few minutes of busy twanging and the occasional whimper as a wizard punctured himself with wire, but eventually they were ready. They looked shyly at one another.
"If we got a pillowcase without a pillow in it and shoved it down inside the chair's robe so the top was showing, he'd look just like a thin man making himself tremendously fat with a huge pillow,"
said one of them enthusiastically. He caught the chair's eye and went quiet. A couple of wizards grasped the handles of Poon's terrible wheelchair and started it rumbling over the damp cobbles.
"Huh? What's that? What's everyone doing?"
said Poon, suddenly waking up.
"We're going to play solid burgers," said the Dean.
"That's a good game," said Poons.
"Can you hear me, old chap?"
The bursar opened his eyes. The university sanitarium wasn't very big and was seldom used. Wizards tended to be either in rude health or dead. The only medicine they generally required was an antacid formula and a dark room until lunch.
"Brought you something to read,"
said the voice diffidently. The bursar managed to focus on the spine of Adventures with Crossbow and Rod.
"Nasty knock you had there, bursar. Been asleep all day?"
The bursar looked blearily at the pink and orange haze, which gradually refined itself into the Arch-Chancellor's pink and orange face.
"Let's see," he thought. "Exactly how did I—"
He sat bolt upright and grabbed the Arch-Chancellor's robe, and screamed into the big pink and orange face,
"Something dreadful's going to happen!"
The wizards strolled through the twilight streets. So far, the disguise was working perfectly. People were even jostling them. No one ever knowingly jostled a wizard. It was a whole new experience. There was a huge crowd of people outside the entrance to the Odeum, and a queue that stretched down the street. The Dean ignored it, and led the party straight up to the doors, whereupon someone said, "Oi!" He looked up at a red-faced troll in an ill-fitting military-looking outfit that included epaulettes the size of kettle drums and no trousers.
"Yes?"
he said.
"There are a queue, you know," said the troll.
The Dean nodded politely. In Ankh-Morpork, a queue was almost by definition something with a wizard at the head of it.
"So I see," he said, "and a very good thing, too. And if you will be so good as to stand aside, we'd like to take our seats."
The troll prodded him in the stomach.
"What you think you are," he said, "a wizard or something?"
This got a laugh from the nearest queuers. The Dean leaned closer.
"As a matter of fact, we are wizards," he hissed.
The troll grinned at him.
"Don't come the raw triple eight with me," he said. "I can see your false beard."
"Now listen,"
the Dean began, but his voice became an incoherent squeak as the troll picked him up by the collar of his robe and propelled him out into the road.
"You get in the queue like everyone else," he said.
There was a chorus of jeers from the queue. The Dean growled and raised his right hand, fingers spread. The chair grabbed his arm.
"Oh, yes," he hissed. "That'd do a lot of good, wouldn't it? Come on."
"Where to?"
"To the back of the queue."
"But we're wizards. Wizards never stand in line for anything."
"We're honest merchants, remember?" said the chair.
He glanced at the nearest click-goers, who were giving them odd looks.
"We're honest merchants,"
he repeated loudly. He nudged the Dean.
"Go on,"
he hissed.
"Go on what?"
"Go on and say something merchanty."
"What sort of thing is that?"
said the Dean, mystified.
"Say something. Everyone's looking at us."
"Oh."
The Dean's face creased in panic, and then salvation dawned.
"Lovely apples," he said. "Get them while they're hot. They're lovely.
Will this do?"
"I suppose so. Now, let's get to the end."
There was a commotion at the other end of the street. People surged forward. The queue broke ranks and charged. The honest merchants were suddenly surrounded by a desperately pushing crowd.
"I say, there is a queue, you know," said the honest merchant in recent rooms diffidently as he was shoved aside.
The Dean grabbed the shoulder of a boy who was ferociously elbowing him aside.
"What's going on, young man?" he demanded.
"They're a coming,"
shouted the boy.
"Who are?"
"The stars."
The wizards, as one man, looked upwards.
"No, they're not," said the Dean,
but the boy had shaken himself free and disappeared in the press of people.
"Strange primitive superstition," said the Dean,
and the wizards, with the exception of Poons, who was complaining and flailing around with his stick, craned forward to see. The Mercer met the Arch-Chancellor in a corridor.
"There's no one in the uncommon room," screamed the Mercer.
"The library's empty,"
bellowed the Arch-Chancellor.
"I've heard about this sort of thing,"
the Mercer whimpered.
"Spontaneous something or other. They've all gone spontaneous."
"Calm down, man. Just because
I can't even find any of the servants. You know what happens when reality gives way? Even now, giant tentacles are probably..."
There was a distant vroom, vroom, vroom noise, and the sound of pellets bouncing off the wall.
"Always in the same direction,"
the Bursar muttered.
"What direction is that, then?"
"The direction they'll be coming from. I think I'm going mad."
"Now, now," said the Arch-Chancellor, patting him on the shoulder. "You don't want to go around talking like that. That's crazy talk."
Ginger stared, panic-stricken, out of the carriage window.
"Who are all these people?"
she said.
"They're fans,"
said Dibbler.
"But I'm not hot."
"Uncle means that they're people who like seeing you in the cliques," said Sol.
Like you a lot."
"There's women out there, too," said Victor.
He gave a cautious wave. In the crowd, a woman swooned.
"You're famous," he said. "You said you always wanted to be famous."
Ginger looked out at the crowd again.
"I never thought it would be like this, though. They're all shouting our names."
"We put a lot of effort into telling people about Blown Away," said Sol.
"Yes," said Dibbler. "We said it was the greatest click in the entire history of Holywood."
"But we've been making clicks for only a couple of months,"
Ginger pointed out.
"So what?" "That's still a history," said Dibbler.
Victor saw the look in Ginger's face. Exactly how long was Holywood's real history? Perhaps there was some ancient stone calendar down there on the seabed among the lobsters. Perhaps there was no way it could be measured. How did you measure the age of an idea?
"A lot of civic dignitaries are going to be there, too," said Dibbler.
the patrician and the nobles and the guild heads and some of the high priests. Not the wizards, of course, the stuck-up old idiots. But it'll be a night to remember, right enough.
Will we have to be introduced to them all? Said Victor.
No, they'll be introduced to you, said Dibbler. It'll be the biggest thrill of their lives.
Victor stared out at the crowds again.
Is it my imagination, he said, or is it getting foggy?
Poons hit the chair across the back of the legs with his stick. Eh, what's going on? He said. Why is everyone cheering?
The patrician just got out of his carriage, said the chair.
Don't see what's so wonderful about that, said Poons. I've got out of carriages hundreds of times. There's no trick to it at all.
It is a bit odd, the chair admitted, and they cheered the head of the Assassin's Guild and the High Priest of Blind Eo, too. And now someone's rolled out a red carpet.
What? In the street? In Ankh-Morpork?
Yes.
Wouldn't like to have their cleaning bill, said Poons.
The lecturer in recent runes nudged the chair heavily in the ribs, or at least at the point where the ribs were overlaid by the strata of 50 years of very good dinners.
Quiet, he hissed. They're coming.
Who? Someone important, by the look of it.
The chair's face creased in panic behind his false red beard.
You don't think they've invited the Arch-Chancellor, do you?
The wizards tried to shrink inside their robes like upright turtles. In fact, it was a far more impressive coach than any of the crumbling items in the university's mews. The crowd surged forward against the line of trolls and city guards and stared expectantly at the carriage door. The very air hummed with anticipation. Mr. Beezam, his chest so inflated with self-importance that he appeared to be floating across the ground, bobbed towards the carriage door and opened it. The crowd held its collective breath, except for a small part of it that hit surrounding people with its stick and muttered,
"What's happening? What's going on? Why won't anyone tell me what's happening? I demand someone tell me what's happening."
The door stayed shut. Ginger was gripping the handle as if it was a lifeline.
"There's thousands of them out there," said Ginger. "I can't go out there."
"But they all watch your clicks," pleaded Sol. "They're your public."
"No!"
Sol threw up his hands.
"Can't you persuade her?"
he said to Victor.
"I'm not even sure I can persuade myself," said Victor.
"But you've spent days in front of these people," said Dibbler. "No, I haven't," said Ginger. "It was just you and the Handleman and the Trolls and everyone. That was different. Anyway, that wasn't really me," she added. "That was Dolores the Sin."
Victor bit his lip thoughtfully.
"Maybe you ought to send Dolores de Sin out there, then," he said.
"How can I do that?" she demanded.
"Well, why not pretend it's a click?"
The Dibblers, uncle and nephew, exchanged glances. Then Sol cupped his hands around his face like the eye of a picture box, and Dibbler, after a prompting nudge, placed one hand on his nephew's head and turned an invisible handle in his ear.
"Action!"
he directed.
End of side 13.